And a very good morning, everybody, and a big welcome to This Is Your Racing Life. And I'm delighted to say that alongside me, for the first time that I've sat in the same studio as this guy, and yet we've worked alongside each other for probably 25 years in broadcast boxes at the racetrack, our special guest this morning is Greg Miles, OAM.
Hello, Brian. I'm still getting used to that. You've had yours for quite some time, but I'm not used to hearing those three letters after my name. But it is a pleasure to be sitting in the same studio with you. We have worked together for a long, long time, and it is the first time I can recall actually being on air with you together.
Exactly. It's great to have you here on such a wonderful day for our racing, being Newmarket Handicap Australian Cup Day. This is Super Saturday, so I'm not going to hold you up for too long. Before we go any further, Chautauqua, can he win?
Oh, I think so, yeah. I was originally worried about the handicap weights, but when you look at it in recent times, it's been more of a top weights race than it's been a bottom weights race. Ooh. So I think probably the three-year-olds are what he's got to worry about, horse like Japanisma. But, I think that devastating sprint up the straight, it'll be something exciting to behold again today.
Well, the Lightning performance was incredible. I wasn't there for the Lightning Stakes, but watching it and listening to your call, he turned sort of total defeat into victory in one bound. Like, it was extraordinary what he did.
It's amazing that he keeps doing it, isn't it? And it'll be a challenge doing it with the handicap today. But he's the escapologist of racing at the moment.
Yes.
He keeps turning defeat into victory, and I don't know how he does it. But he'll be a heart and mouth job again today, no doubt.
And Greg, the lane that he's drawn, lane 11, that keeps him in a sort of clear air, doesn't it?
Yeah. I think
it's
better
that
way.
Gate,
rather than ducking and weaving and trying to come through the inside, which is always a bit hard to do. Usually, you just get the clear air on the outside. And if you can work out how the Flemington Straight's going to play, it seems to be the better place to be. It certainly was last week.
Well, that's racing, and most people know sort of a fair bit about the form today. But let's talk about Greg Miles. Gee, what a career, mate. What a career. 35 Melbourne Cups. How in the hell did you do that?
I don't know. It still seems to me like it snuck up on me. I was a very young man when I started. I was very, very fortunate. And as you know, you get bitten by the bug of racing first, and then you think, well, I'd like to get involved in the game second. And race calling it was a bug within me that I just wanted to do it from the time I was still in primary school, I recall. And I think we're all sort of tragics in that way. You start in this game as a young kid wanting to be a race caller, and then just hope like hell that the door's open for you. And I was extremely lucky that I ended up getting a job at the ABC and had people in my corner like Dick Mason, like Peter Booth, and certainly like Joe Brown. And I let them know what I was interested in doing. I was hacking around doing greyhounds at Wangaratta and, you know, the odd trial meeting here and there, and wasn't getting too far until I got to the ABC. And I really didn't know, but Joe Brown was thinking about retiring. He was about 59, 60 when I got there. And he retired by the time he was 62. And I, at the time, was 21 years of age, and they decided to give me a go. Now, that's something that, you know, radio stations wouldn't normally do. But that's the ABC. They were keen on nurturing their own rather than going out and buying a bought one, you know, one off the tree. they grew their own one.
Just back to school days, I found the kids in the class or kids within my group that were the racing kids. We sort of quickly teamed up. Did you find that? Did you find the guys that you had racing in common with?
I found that I was probably the first part of racing's lost era, because the kids I went to school with had no idea about racing. I was their bookmaker and had to teach them how to lose their money. I toted off to the races pretty much on my own most days. Couldn't get a buddy to go with. They just had no interest. Football was all the rage. This was back in the late 1970s, and I would have thought, or middle 70s, I would have thought there would have been young guys interested in racing, but I was a bit of a one-outer at the school I was at.
That's interesting, because at St. Joseph's Tech, where I was, sort of 63, 64, I remember taking the bets, you know, and producing actually little slips as the bookie, and got a skinner when Polo Prince won. I kept my foot on Polo Prince. I really liked him. So I got a result out of him, and at Parade College, I'd change the kids in the class, I'd have about six or seven guys that I could get to run around the oval. I'd change their names to Sky High and Sailor's Guide and Dawler Geary, and we'd do a whole race card around the oval at Parade College.
So you were very lucky in that regard. I took on Vanderham. That was my greatest fault.
And the rain came.
Yeah, and the rain came and I got stitched up. Oh, there are still kids out there I owe.
Oh, marvellous. We, my brother and I actually had plastic horses on a string. And it was a game called Race Play, and the track was about 2.5 metres long. And you'd wind them all on just one steel winder. And there were 8 horses on the string, and they had little jockeys on them. And we'd put Band-Aids on their back and colour them into the horses of the 60s. We'd have a race meeting every night, you know. So
fantastic.
We're racing under lights very early in those days. Did you have something like that? Like, I remember listening to Bill Collins talk of his life and other guys, Johnny Tapp and people like that, have been wonderful broadcasters, and they'd say they'd have, icy pole sticks going down a gutter and things like that and doing their race calls.
Yeah, I used to just entertain myself. I'd walk my dog around a certain course, and we'd have each block would represent a race of the Craigley Stakes would be first, and each light pole or tree would be the furlong poles. And he was a pretty keen goer. I had to restrain him a bit to change the results a few times.
Ah, great times. What about Mum and Dad? I don't think I ever met your mum, but I knew your dad well because it was always wonderful for me being a little bit older, but being in the broadcast box alongside. And your dad, Les, he was a lovely man, and he was so proud of you, a young man making it into the older man's game in race calling.
Yeah.
And he was just a terrific man. I don't have to tell you that, but He was a great great assistant, wasn't he? You know, he'd be answering the phone, broadcast, it's the steward's calling or whatever.
Yeah, oh, he was fantastic. When he retired, I said, you better come to the races with me. So he'd come to every midweeker and the occasional one on the weekend. And, he was fantastic. He was just fantastic to have in the box because he was just such a wonderful support.
Yes.
And, he'd answer the phones and take messages, and it sort of filled his day and got him out of Mum's hair for a while. I miss him greatly. He's been gone about 9 years now. So, loved having him with me. And he did have a good interest in the racing, and we'd go down and have a beer after the last in the committee room. And he made friends very, very easily. Mm. Good listener and great man.
Those days are gone now after the races. I remember sort of going through the country tracks and the city tracks too. After the last, you'd go and the committee would, be there waiting for you to give you a beer and talk about the day's racing. The stewards would come in with the steward's report. But
doesn't happen much nowadays. No.
How are you keeping up with the pace, Greg? Because night racing is a big part of our whole calendar now, and we're night racing out at Pakenham, Narnagoon, Moonee Valley on a Friday night. I know I did sort of a couple of seasons of Friday nights and then into the Saturday, but I found those Friday nights so taxing mentally.
Yeah, I call it the relentless pursuit because that's what racing is nowadays. Yeah. It's more than 7 days a week now. We've got 2 meetings on a day quite often with the Friday nights and the Thursday afternoons and what have you. So it is. It's a tough game to keep on top of, and it's full time. I call 3 times a week, but apart from going to the races, you're getting ready to go to the races, and that takes a full day nowadays. Or you're reviewing a meeting that you've already been to, or one that you haven't seen. So it is. It's a absolute full time job to keep on top of the form. There's that much information out there nowadays, and we've got to know at least as much as our listeners and our viewers. So it's, and for the participants, it's particularly hard. I mean, it's okay for us to sit in the broadcast box and call them, but for the players out there, the jockeys who are finishing up at midnight and then they're up and going track work in the morning, it's a game that's taking its toll on people. And I think there is too much of it, but we've created the monster now. How do you wind it back in?
Well, you don't wind it back in, which is sad because there is a call across from jockeys and particularly trainers too. We'd love to have a day off. We'd love to have just one day. If it's Monday, just race free. But I go to the track a lot, Flemington, to see different horses I'm involved in and to watch them work. And you see the strain on these guys. They're getting up at 3 and 3:30, and quite often the day will go afternoon racing and then stretch into the night. So it's a relentless, as you say, the relentless pursuit. But it does affect their life. I can see it in trainers. I can see it in jockeys.
Yeah, Yes, I guess something's got to be done, and I hope that they do look at that. And I think a day off a week and a Monday would be an ideal situation. But and there's ways around it, I'm sure. If we have one day race free, then add one race onto every other day during the week, and
get them covered,
and have nine race cards, and you've got the turnover covered, surely. Yeah.
So today we're racing at Flemington, of course. How much work would you put in preparation for today?
I would have started Thursday, have a good look at the form Thursday, and then tidy it all up on a Friday. But it depends on the size of the fields. It can take anywhere 8, 10, 12 hours to get ready. And people have asked me, how do you prepare? What do you do? And I said, well, for argument's sake, if I were to look at one horse and assess one horse, and I know we all do the same, you might look at a replay, have a look at its colours, put it into a speed map, might look at a couple of replays. You may have to look at its breeding, what did it sell for at the yearling sales, or better check a pronunciation. If you spend 5 minutes doing that on one horse, and you've got a 12-horse race, there's 1 hour.
Yeah.
You've got 8 races, there's 8 hours. If you've got 10 races often in the spring, well, there's at least 10. Sometimes the fields are 16, 18. So you can easily spend 12, 14 hours preparing for a race meeting, and all you've spent is 5 minutes looking at one horse.
Yep.
So it's pretty easy to spend a lot of time getting ready.
I find preparing for the races we do here on a Saturday, and it hasn't really changed from the radio days of bygone years for me, watching the replay of every horse, but also, you know, you'll charge into the first, into the second, into the third, and you get to about race seven and just, you know, start to wane a little bit.
Yeah.
And the last, you say, I know it, because it's half past 10 at night. It's time for bed.
That's right. Yeah, it's a game that if you don't do that, you're very easily found out.
Oh, yes. Yeah, no, so no
it's
question.
It's probably 9 parts homework, 1 part performance these days.
Did you ever imagine sort of going back and your first Melbourne Cup call was 1981 and that was won by Just a Dash? Did you imagine that sort of 35, 36 years down the line, this is where it'd be, this is how it'd be happening, you'd have this on your CV of 35 Melbourne Cups?
No.
To me, it was, if I ever got a chance to call a Melbourne Cup, that'd be terrific. And I think we all just aim for that, and anything else is a bonus.
Yeah, absolutely. When I first started, and I was, as I said earlier, I was very fortunate that I started virtually calling Metropolitan Racing. Didn't do much provincials until a bit later on. So I was very, very lucky in that regard. And before I knew it, I was calling all the big races and called a Melbourne Cup within the first 6 or 8 months of being a full-timer. And I thought, well, if I can do this for a few years, if I could get 10 under my belt, that would be fantastic. But through one reason or another, and the ABC's doors closed, and then Sky Channel came along, and then they lost the rights, and then UZ came along because you'd moved. So, it's been very fortunate that I haven't had a miss anywhere, and for the time being, touch wood, it's still happening.
Well, I retired to give you a go.
That was very kind of you. I didn't get your wage, though, apparently.
Neither did I. They've been great times, and we'd meet quite often, last Saturday, for instance. I mightn't see you all day. I might see you at the back where we have a cup of tea. But I don't think people can appreciate how lonely the broadcast box is. God, you spend a lot of time on your own, don't you?
You do, yeah. And I think Clem Dimsey coined that phrase many, many years ago, that it's a very lonely sport because, they jump in a two-mile race and you've got 3.5 minutes on your own. It's not like calling a game of football where if you're not too sure of the bloke running into goal, you can just give the bloke next to you a bit of a nudge and he'll help you out.
Yeah.
You're on your own out there. Yeah. And if you run into trouble, it's all your own responsibility. So,
The beauty of, I think, of race calling, I've always found, and I'm sure you're the same, is it's one take. It's one take. You don't get a chance to come back and do it again. So, well, look, let's do take two or take three and we'll get it right. It's one take on the line. You've just got that split second decision.
Yeah, I don't think there's a more pressurised environment in which to work in broadcasting. Because, as you say, there are no second takes on it. And there's nobody else to ask. So, and it's over in a flash. And you can sometimes feel, if you're sort of grappling for one name, you can feel the race running away from you all of a sudden.
Yeah.
So it's all about flow. And Tim Lane told me, you never, ever can question yourself in fast sports. And he's called a lot of different sports. And he said, the moment you start to question yourself, that's when it can unravel. So you've just got to trust that your instinct is right. You see a little flash of red and you think, yeah, I know exactly what that is. You never double question yourself, otherwise it'll all unravel in front of you.
And it's that horse who moves up on the outside. You can see the jockey's cap, but you can't see the body of the jockey.
Mm.
And that's when, you know, you've got those little catch cries, and we all use them, further back on the outside, making up ground, coming into the picture. At the same time, your brain is scanning for what that horse is. It's amazing how it can help you too. It'll pick it up.
Absolutely, yeah. Just that little bit of padding every now and again to make sure you've got it right. So,
what was the old cliche is, what's this at 100 miles an hour down the extreme outside, coming with a withering run?
Searching,
and the old times
have
been going through the race book, and it's number 23 on page 7.
Race books are a little bit too big to hold together.
When they put the pedigrees on the other page?
Yeah, no help to us.
No. Greg Miles, wonderful broadcaster. We're chewing the fat here, and we're talking about a great racing life. For Tobin Brothers Funeral, celebrating life. We'll be back in just a moment. Greg Miles joins us, racing commentator extraordinaire, and it's been a long innings, and it is far from over. Greg, Williamstown boy, born in October 1959. Of course, you'd know a little bit about, I'm sure you being a, I think you've got a big interest in history. Farlap, he won at Williamstown Racecourse, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
Did he win the Orr?
He was first up in, I think, an Underwood Stakes.
Underwood, yes.
And he was as big as a house, apparently. And they bet black figures about him.
Did you get the black figures?
Unfortunately, you know, there's, I guess, every now and again you think, would it be nice to be transported in time?
Yes.
And there are places you'd like to be and witness something. And that's the one thing I'd love to have
just to be dropped into 1931 or something.
Yeah.
I agree.
And be at Williamstown in my backyard and watch Farlap race. I think that would be extraordinary. Yeah, so he had one start there and he won. And it's part of my little fitness regime. I go for jogs around that area, and you can still see the remnants of the old stand and stand there and imagine where Farlap would have raced. It's really quite fascinating for me.
Yeah, the Williamstown Racing Club actually became the Melbourne Racing Club, and they amalgamated, didn't they? Because I can remember the Williamstown Cup being run at Sandown probably in the later 60s and might have even been run at Caulfield as well.
That's its history. It's now I guess it's a zipping classic nowadays.
Yes. Yeah.
Formerly the Sandown Cup and the Williamstown Cup before that, yeah.
So where's that Williamstown course in relation to the old rifle range? Is that the same area?
Yeah, if you were heading away from the city along Corroy Creek Road, you'd pass the old rifle range on your left-hand side and keep going. It's now behind a whole bunch of old tanks and a refinery and what have you in there. So the railway line that runs to Altona, from Williamstown to Altona, would be right alongside the side of the racetrack.
I think that's right. It did pull up at the racetrack. There was a stop there, wasn't there?
Yeah.
Wonderful days. Now, so what about Dad, Les? What did he do? Did he have any involvement in racing?
No, he didn't. He was a sheepskin classer.
Was he?
Yeah, ran his own business, and he was very good at it too. And when I was a little tacker, he dragged me along to some of the markets off in Ballarat and what have you, and he'd set the prices and set the tone of the buying. He was very good. He worked for a lot of different people, but he went out on his own, and that's when he made some money. But then the bigger multinational companies came in and wool classing and wool buying and squeezed him out. His interest in horse racing really was little more than the old four place cards with the SP bookie at the local pub.
Yep.
And I'd help him fill them out, and we'd listen to the races on the Saturday. And that's what got me interested in the racing in the first place, just listening to the great race quarters of the time, and such vibrancy and urgency and information flowing out of the radio. I thought, wow, what's this? I've got to get interested in this.
That's exactly. I know what you're talking about, because I remember listening to the Melbourne Cup in 1956, and I'd won the sweep. We're in West Ivanhoe, where we lived, and I drew Evening Peel. So we were told to sit down in the lounge room by Dad with my two older brothers, sit there, we're going to listen to the Melbourne Cup and hold your little slip up, because this is what you've drawn in the sweep. And first prize was $2, and I had an Evening Peel. So I heard out of this Bakelite box with the little lights at the front of the radio stations listed, I heard this race call come out of this Bakelite box. And being an inquisitive little six-year-old, around the back of the box to see where the little man was, because the call, I can still hear the call now. I don't know what station it was, whether it was Bill Collins or Bert Bright or Joe. I can still hear it. And I was bitten same way. The clarity of the radio was king, and you're getting this coming at you. And they had such commanding voices, and Yeah, it got me, like you.
Yeah, that's the same thing that happened to me a few years later. I think it was about 10 years between us.
Yeah.
And it was 68 or 69. It was one of Rain Lovers that I listened to first off, and I thought, wow, I'm hooked on this. And it was a few years later than that I first went to the racetrack. Dad took me to the races at Werribee, which, living in Williamstown, was probably our closest track. And that's when I was completely gone. You know, you walk on a racetrack and it had that feel, that vibe, I guess, for the want of another term, and the sights and the smells, and you just get caught up in all of that. Yeah.
Isn't it funny, as a young person, you remember the smell of different things, like the smell of the hot dogs, or the pie stall, or going down by the horse stalls.
The horse pup.
or the race book that had just been freshly printed.
Yeah.
All those things, as a young person, sort of you absorbed it all, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And through those pubs, you talk about your dad, you know, with the SPs and the four-place cards. God, the number of pubs through Williamstown, like that was a drinking man's town. It was where the seafarers were, the waterside workers lived, and the old cottages, and there's a pub on every corner.
Yeah, there was well over, I can't remember the number, but there was well over 30 or 40 pubs in the old days there.
Did you try them all?
A few of them closed before I got old enough to get inside it.
Probably good.
I know them all now, though.
But great times.
Oh, yeah, fantastic, fantastic.
So, your first call actually was July 3, Grand National Day, 1981. And, of course, the Cup came up in November of the same year. You were 21 years of age. How did you feel? Now, the Grand Nationals in those days, they went 6.5 minutes. It was a big day to be launching.
Yeah, that's right. Joe had retired, and I'd started doing quite a lot of the race calls on the day. Joe was calling one or two in the last few months of his career, so he gave me a good grounding and a good start. But I did love the jumps in those days, and fell in love with a mare called Eleonora Girl. Remember her? She was a beauty. And when Samoy got up and beat her in that national, I think it was 82, when he beat her for the second time, I didn't forgive him for quite some time.
Remember those wonderful jumpers, Belle Flight, and those horses that came over from New Zealand? Aircon.
I think I called Aircon. Belle Flight was in the late 70s. It was just before me, but I was there the day he met his demise, unfortunately, in the national after he'd won the crisp by a space, and then he reckon he's down.
A jump in front, wasn't he, in the crisp or the national?
He was a jump clear on that in that jumpers lane with a lap to go and broke down, unfortunately.
Gogong?
Yeah, Gogong, I do remember him. He was a dasher, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Beauty. Geordie Julius rode him, didn't he?
I think you're right. Yeah. I think you're right. That's when jumping racing was, you know, such a marvellous winter sport here. But it's faced its battles. But Warrnambool has been the salvation of jumps racing. And I think it's wonderful that, you know, the jumping people realised to survive, a lot of things had to change. And they did change them. They did change them. And they met the KPIs, as they say. And you know, with the great old horse that's won the National in the last, 3 years? When the National was up at Ballarat last winter?
Yeah. Well, they're trying to retire him, of course, but hopefully the rules will change and Bash Boy will be able to come back and race as a 13-year-old. I think they did change it for the worst. I mean, the naysayers changed the racing that much that we ended up with these fences that were bringing the horses down,
and it was too quick.
It was too dangerous. So I think they've now, with these new fences that they've built now, I think they've got it just about right, and the game's back on track again, hopefully.
So we got you started in 1981. Now, in 1985, you're off to England to do what very few Australian race callers have done, and that's call the English Derby. What a thrill.
Well, it would have been. Unfortunately, we met a major issue over there. I did go over with the intent of calling it, and I'd prepared, and it was Slip Anchor's year in 85, and we're all set to go, and then the BBC threw in a curveball to the ABC, and they wanted a rights fee for it, for a radio broadcast that was going to be back in Melbourne, you know, well after midnight. It was going to cost 250 quid, I believe.
It's a bit of money.
Well, it was $500 Australian in 1985, and the ABC said, no, we can't afford to pay that. There's just not value in it. So the OB was cancelled, and lo and behold, about the day before the derby, the BBC changed their tune and said, look, you can have it for a nominal fee, whatever it was, 20 quid or something. Yeah. But by that time, the OB had been dismantled and there was no one to mount it. So I went along to watch Slip Anchor win by a dozen lengths and didn't get to call the race.
It would have been an easy call, wouldn't it?
It would have been a breeze. It was one of the smallest derby fields in history.
Oh.
So, it was rather disappointing, but, you know, so what, you know?
You know, it would have been wonderful to have that on your CV. Bill Collins did it back in the 60s, and he went to America and followed Tobin Bronze. I think Tappy called an English derby, John Tapp, but not too many have done it. Would have been a wonderful feather in your cap.
Yeah, it would have been nice to have done, but, que sera, you know, these things happen for a reason, perhaps, I don't know, but it was disappointing at the time. But I was over there anyway. It wasn't like I'd been sent over to call the derby. I was actually on my honeymoon, and I took Alison to see about 16 different racetracks.
And your binoculars.
Wouldn't get away with it 30 years later.
No way. You haven't done a lot of calling outside Australia. I remember we went to the opening of the Avondale night meeting back in about the late 80s, would it be?
Yeah, we did. That was the night racing, which didn't last too long in New Zealand those times. We did go over. Four of us went over and called, four Australian callers against the four New Zealand callers.
Yeah,
it
was you, David Morrow, myself, and who's the other Australian? Was it Wayne? Wayne Wilson?
Wayne Wilson.
Yeah.
So we got a field of five. Good on you, Wayne.
That's right.
Early in the night.
That's right. There were four Australians against the four New Zealand callers. Yeah. And an eight-race card, and they judged the calls as to who the winning team was. We won. The Aussies got up and won, and we all got a horseshoe of bone crushers.
Bone crusher, which I still have proudly at home, yeah. So, but I've only called there. I've called in Hong Kong, and I called in Dubai. With Terry Spargo a few years ago, about 10 years ago, when Kieran McAvoy first went over there. So not too many places, but it's hard enough keeping up with the form at home without having to worry about overseas.
Where do you find it's the toughest place to call? I think Flemington still is the toughest, and there's something about being at Flemington.
It's a beast, I think, Flemington.
Good description.
on many days, like today, the fields aren't too big, so it's not going to be a massive challenge. Yeah. But you go to Flemington on carnival time, and you get those huge fields every race, and they come at you one after another. And look, it's a beautiful racetrack. It's one of my favourite parts of the world, let alone being a race course. I just love being at Flemington race day or not. But great racetrack, terrible broadcast box. One of the worst in the country.
Yeah, I remember a few years ago we sort of petitioned to try and get the two boxes, your box and my box, moved up next to the judge, and we went up to the judge's box, which had no sort of parapet out the front. It was just a sheer drop in front. And I got giddy. I said, not for me. It's too far up.
Yeah.
But I don't think people realise the angle, because we're not on the same angle as the outside running row. We're on a different curve, so to speak. Gee, that makes it tough, doesn't it?
Yeah, they seem to just... The races, particularly the straight races, just change shape so quickly in the last 100 metres or so. It's a nightmare place to call. But there are plans drawn up. Ben, we've just got to hang in long enough. There are plans drawn up for us to go above the Panorama restaurant.
Yeah.
And they've been drawn up and costed. And they're too expensive. So
I was getting excited. I was going to hang on for that.
Well, we should start some kind of a charitable draw and sell a few of those raffle tickets that you used to do at St. Pat's or something.
St. Joe's.
St. Joe's.
Anyone listening, if you want to donate to the new broadcast box at Flemington, I'll give you the email address shortly. What about your time away from race calling? And there's not a lot of time away, but you love the water. You're down at Williamstown, and you've finally been sort of seduced into yachting and boating.
Yeah. Well, I thought I was just before I turned 50, and I said to Alison, I think I've got to do something, otherwise I'm going to end up one of those tragic old race goers who just fronts up to the race course all the time with nothing to do. I said, we'll have to find something to do. So we'd live near the water, we'd holiday near the water, and I'd always harboured a coveted getting a boat. So I went out and started researching it. I joined the local yacht club and stayed for about a year and badgered the old salts in there to what am I going to buy, what am I going to get, and took about 12 months of research, and I eventually found a lovely old clipper cruiser, and I'm in love with her and spend a lot of time on board just tinkering and pottering around and fixing it up and going out and cruising and just love it. It's a great pastime.
How far from home do you go on it?
This summer we went out through the head, so that sort of opened up a whole new ball game for us. We've just potted around the bay, because, I mean, I hadn't had a paddleboard before about 5 years ago, so it's a great learning curve, knowing what's going on out there. So we're starting to grow our wings a little bit, and, you know, eventually in time we're planning to take her down to Tasmania for a stay, and then up the coast and up to Queensland, northern Queensland. That would be about as far as we'll go. But right at the moment, we're just learning the ropes in the bay.
Mm. How relaxing is it?
It's fantastic. Yeah. Stressful, but...
Is it really?
Yeah, well, I mean, out there with a couple
of... You've got to have your wits about you, don't you?
You've got to know what you're doing and what the other people are, what the other yachts are doing and what have you. And berthing is always an issue. I think anybody that's had a boat will tell you that, you know, your heart does go up a few more beats when you've got to come in for berthing. There's wind and tide and what have you. So it's all of those little issues, and it's a great learning process. And you've got to learn with your deckie as well. So you're learning at the same time and crashing at the same time.
I was going to say, how many times have you hit the wharf?
Oh, yeah, a couple. Not too keen to expose too much information there.
That's why they have the rubber tyres there, isn't it?
My insurance company knows what's going on.
That's good that you've got something that you can turn to, because racing, and I know race calling, having done it for 242 years now, yes. it does consume your life.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's all consuming. You've got to have a pastime, and golf is a popular one for a lot of the jockeys and what have you, but you've got to do something, otherwise it becomes all too consuming, and you just need that outlet just to have the release for the brain, to have a little bit of a breather, you know.
Yeah, that's good news. We're talking with Greg Miles, our guest this morning, and we're going for a commercial break. Then we'll come back and talk about the great gallopers that Greg has called and those Mackaybe Diva years. This is Your Racing Life with Greg Miles for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Back with Greg Miles, and this is Your Racing Life, Flemington today, and it's Super Saturday. Talking of Flemington, tell me what happened when Joe Brown came into the broadcast box one day and you had your strides around your ankles. What happened?
Your researcher has done a marvellous job.
That's me. I'm the researcher. I'm the producer, the director of the lot.
You've spent a lot of time. Let me try and remember what had happened that time. I don't do gardening anymore at home, but I did on that particular occasion. And I, as I recall, because this is going back nearly 30 years ago, I think, I'd got bitten by some spider and my hand had blown up. It was quite painful, actually. And Joe Brown had called for the doctor, the on-course doctor, to come and see me. And the horses were heading out to the stalls for the first race on this occasion. He said, "I can see what's happened to you. You've got some kind of a medical reaction to a spider bite there." He said, "You just need a anti-inflammatory injection and you'll be right, so drop your strides and away we'll go." So that was what happened. They were going to the stalls and I was learning the horse's colours, and he jabbed me in the bum, and Joe Brown walked in at just that moment. Said, "What's going on here?" Would have been quite a sight, I'm sure.
Did you pull your strides up for the race?
Absolutely. I try to remain fully dressed when I call. It's one of those things.
Greg, I always believe that as race callers, the great moments are the measure of great horses, the moments that they give us as broadcasters, but what they give the racing fans as well. You know, Mackaybe Diva, third Melbourne Cup, and the beautiful line that you used, and you'll take that to your grave. And I know that if you can get that right line for the right moment, if you can deliver it and make sure it does work, because if it doesn't work and they get beaten in a photo, it's bang, you're down.
Yeah, but your face is not
a beautiful line, a champion becomes a legend.
Well, in the lead up to that race, we were doing a preview on the Monday before the Melbourne Cup, and one of our guests on RSM was Bruce McAvaney, and he said, "I'm sure that Greg has a line ready to deliver, because it's going to be much the same sort of moment that when he called Cathy winning that Sydney Olympic." And my stomach turned over in the studio. I thought, I haven't actually thought of anything yet. So it was quite a sleepless night, as can happen on a Monday night before a Melbourne Cup, as you well know. And I was tossing a few ideas around, and that was one of about three or four that popped into my head. And when I thought of it, I thought, well, I'll try and use that. And God bless her, she made it easy. As you know, you called that Melbourne Cup as well, and she just peeled out. And when she did, and she appeared 300 or 400 metres out, she was always going to win the race. So it was just a matter of waiting for the right moment.
And you delivered it beautifully. But it's interesting how champion horses can just, when they range up and your own radar tells you, this is going to win. Like there is no way, unless the earth opens up and there's a, you know, you get swallowed up by the ground, she is home or he is home. It's like Might and Power in a Cox Plate. It's like any of those great moments that horses deliver. What about that wonderful call of Bill Collins, the bone crusher, our Waverley star. You were calling for the ABC that day?
Yep, I was.
The Cox play?
Yep, yeah. I think there were about five callers in those days, you know, with Frank O'Brien calling and UZ would have been JR in those days. And Channel 10 was, Bruce. At that stage, it was Bruce McAvaney. Yeah. He was right alongside me. And after the race, he dashed down and did an interview for television. When he came back up, he said, "How'd you go?" And I said, "I think I went okay." "How'd you go?" He said, "I think I went okay." And that night we heard Bill Collins call and we realised that we just went okay. You know? He did nail it, yeah.
Beautiful call, wasn't it?
Fantastic, yeah. Fantastic.
The beauty of Bill Collins, and I worked with Bill from 84 to 88 and then took over as the chief caller, which eternally grateful for, but he, because of his showbiz background, you know, he was a singer, a dancer, he could do anything.
He could do anything.
An amazing man, but he knew the importance of the moment. He could capture the moment and deliver it so eloquently and so precisely. And so he was the complete race caller, performer, all rolled up into one.
Absolutely, yeah, could capture a moment. And I spoke to him not too long before he died and I said, you know, "Did you have anything prepared for that? For that call?" He said, "Yes, I did. You know, I did have a think about it before the race." I said, "Well, was it your best call?" He said, "I don't think so."
Really?
"What was?" He said, "I think that Australian Cup, that bone crusher, he'll have to be everything we think of him, you know."
Beautiful call.
Yeah. And none of that could possibly be rehearsed. And you can hear the thump of the desk as bone crusher lunged and just nabbed that tallack, I think it was.
Yeah.
That. The hair on the back of my neck still stands up when I think about it.
Yeah. Will the champ get up? He lunges, and then there's that bang.
Yes, he will. Yeah, great.
Brilliant.
Call.
Brilliant.
Just captures the moment.
And I believe that people like yourself and people like me that have come through after those wonderful broadcasters who really, you know, they gave us the lead a long time ago when we were young guys coming through. They were the ones. They were the ones that we wanted to be.
Yeah.
We were so lucky.
Well, they set the template.
Of course
they set
did.
The bar as high as they did and gave us something to aspire to. And I think for just about everybody that's listened to Bill Collins, there's a little bit of Bill in just about every broadcaster, particularly any Victorian broadcaster, just as there would be a bit of Ken Howard in the Sydney guys and so on in around Brisbane and over in Perth. They have their idols and they sound a little bit like them.
Yeah, you're right, because the twang out of sort of Queensland has always been different. The Sydney twang has been a little bit different, but I reckon we're different again down here. And I've always said to callers coming along through the ranks that one thing you should remember, I believe, with this profession is that we're just the custodians of this profession. You know, it's been handed on to us from great, great broadcasters. So whatever our time is, look after it and then pass it on. But look after it.
Absolutely, yeah, and it's an evolving thing as well.
Of course it is.
I mean, you listen to the calls from the early 60s; they're completely different now because there's a huge television component to it. These days, and I think we've slowed up a little bit, and it does change and evolve as it naturally should. But I still think the Australian race callers are up there amongst the best in the world, and the British are getting pretty darn close these days. But it's a different world, and you're right. I think we're only in it for a short time when you consider it started in 1925. So we haven't been around all that long, have we?
It's interesting how our trade, the Australian broadcaster, you've had Jim McGrath, top of the tree for 20, 25 years with the BBC, now retired. Michael Rona through America. The Aussie boys calling in Hong Kong, calling in Singapore. Dubai. You know, we've spread ourselves wide and far, so it's a profession, you know, we all should be very proud of.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I'm very proud to be a part of it, as you would be, and these boys are doing a fantastic job all across the world.
Yeah, some wonderful talent coming through too here in Australia. Greg, what about the Caulfield Cup? So if you've done 35 Melbourne Cups, you've done 35 Caulfield Cups, you've done 35 Cox Plates.
Yep.
It all goes in one big set. It's a beauty.
I've been fortunate that I've been around for all of them.
Yeah. Now, you weren't well on Caulfield Cup Day. I didn't see you. I didn't see you through the day because although we might be alongside each other, you're so engrossed in the work that you're doing. But your health wasn't right.
Yeah. Look, it's a low moment in the 35 years. I wasn't right Caulfield Guineas Day. Certainly wasn't right on the Wednesday. I probably shouldn't have been there, but I patched myself up with some...
Well, you want to be there, don't you?
Yeah, you have to be. And I guess there was a little bit of talk about 35 cups and breaking Bill Collins' record and all that sort of thing. But I'd been really knocked about quite badly with a severe dose of hay fever. And I don't know if people, if you've had it, you know how it can really sap you. And I had it for a couple of weeks, just couldn't move it on. Normally I've been able to control it all, but I wasn't able to. And I went to my doctor on the Thursday before Caulfield Cup Day, and he said, well, there is a magic drug if you'd like to try it. And I said, of course I'll try it. So it was just a steroid thing, a corticosteroid, which I took, and I felt fine. But the what I wasn't aware of was the side effects, which are anxiety and shortness of breath. And in the pressure of just prior to a Caulfield Cup, naturally your heart rate goes up a little bit, and you do become a little bit more tense and anxious. And
could you feel it coming on?
Yeah, just before the start of the race. It was a dreadful feeling, and I couldn't breathe properly. My breathing rate was down to about half what it should have been, and about a mile out, I was actually fearful that I wasn't going to finish the race, to be honest. So the fact that I mispronounced Mongolian Khan and call it Magnolian Khan was lost on me, to be honest. I didn't even know until I was driving home and I heard a replay on the radio and nearly ran off the road. So so I understand why people got upset with what I'd done, but I felt terrible about it for quite a long, long time, and it was probably made it the most difficult spring carnival I've ever called in my life, because I felt there was a few baying for my blood, and if I'd made another blue, that would have been just about it, you know. So it was, I created the problem myself by turning up when I shouldn't have, I suppose, but it was a darn tough carnival.
Yeah, okay, I can understand what you're saying, but we're human. We're only human. Jack Ayling told me back in the 70s, I put the wrong dog in the wrong box one night at Olympic Park. I put number 10 into box 2, and it should have been number 9, the emergency, in the first leg of the double, and sent the wrong dog around and called it the winner. I was devastated. I was only a young guy, and I thought, that's it. My career's lasted 18 months. It's over. And Jack Ayling said to me, great, I'll rack on tour, Jack Ayling. And he said, smacker. He said, I'll tell you one thing. He said, the bloke who put a rubber on the end of a pencil made a fortune.
That's right. So.
And I've never, ever forgotten that.
Yeah.
But in the world we live now, there are haters, and there are more haters, and the haters will keep hating. So social media is a wonderful outlet for the keyboard caper and the anonymous haters, and it's sad, and you see what they do to celebrities, and they'll have a crack at you, because it's a profile job, it's a high profile job, whether you like it or not. But you're sitting there, you're doing it. They'll have a crack at you.
Yep,
and it's unfair. It's terribly unfair. But the world doesn't work that way anymore.
No, it doesn't. And we're out there, and it's a public life in many ways, I suppose.
Yep.
And if they're going to give you a pat on the back when you do well, then you've got to take the slap in the face when you don't do well.
Yeah.
So
that's what.
But I thought it was a bit relentless, and it did affect me, I must admit. So I'm a non-player in the social media world.
Yeah, good on you.
And I'm happy for it.
I remember seeing you, and I remember seeing the news that night at the ABC. I didn't know how your call went, because I was there doing it for SEN.
Sure, yeah.
And I said to my wife, watching it on the replay, just the last portion, the last 600 metres, I said, Greg doesn't seem to be right. He's gasping for air or whatever.
Yeah.
And I didn't even realise that you'd had Magnolia and Mongolian. But then I saw your Cox Plate day and realised, the fallout. And I said, how are you doing? And you had the eye of the tiger, and you were going to really let rip Cox Plate day. You were ready for the fight, weren't you?
I had to.
And you did.
I was playing for my life, I felt.
Oh, you did. And you did it so well. Of all the cups, the Maccabi Diva we spoke about, there's been some wonderful moments that racing's given you, and you've been able to convey as a broadcaster.
I've been very fortunate. When I first started in 1981, and I was so envious of the great horses that the previous quarters had been able to, the likes of Galilee and all these wonderful names, Rain Lovers and, Light Fingers. I thought, gosh, we'll never get an era like that again, will we?
Yeah.
Well, lo and behold, I think we've seen the very best of the Melbourne Cup in our time. And the internationalisation of it all, seen some fantastic races, and we've seen the face of the Melbourne Cup change from Vintage Crop when he won it,
We didn't realise how much it was going to change the internationalisation of the race, did we?
Not at the time. No. Just the effect that it's had, and it's turned it into one of the great races of the world. I think we probably kidded ourselves in the 60s and 70s that it was, you know, the race that stopped the nation and the whole world's watching, but they weren't really.
Exactly.
But now they do.
And just when we were nearly resigned to the fact that it was going to go offshore every year, it was going to go back to France or to Ireland or to Germany or whatever, along came Michelle Payne and a little horse from Ballarat called Prince of Penzance and saved the whole thing.
Yeah, and that'll keep happening. We saw Rogan Josh do it a few years earlier, you know. So the Aussies will have their moments. There's no doubt about that. And I think that was one of the great stories of the Melbourne Cup with Michelle Payne winning it on that 100-1 outside. I had to check the book a couple of times.
So did I. Yeah, I did sort of when they got to about the 150, because Prince of Penzance colours were not similar to anyone else's. You know, quite often you might have five Godolphins, or Lloyd Williams might have five or six with the...
It's happened,
yeah. Yeah, it has, with the different caps. But the Prince of Penzance were quite distinct. Mm. And I don't know about you, but I went for the book when it loomed up and you could see it had the race won. I thought, this can't be Prince of Penzance.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've only got a split second to do it.
That's right. Yeah, it's like, remember the guy called Wotan? He probably did the same thing.
Yeah, Wotan.
And it went.
Yeah, exactly right. So the 35 cups on the board, that record's not going to be broken.
We won't see it anyway.
We won't see it. So what does the future hold now?
I'm not sure. I'm 56, so I think I've got a few good years left.
Yeah, chicken.
Chicken, yeah. But you can't keep going forever. And I think I've got about 18 months left on a contract at the moment. And I'll review that at the end of two more Melbourne Cups and see where we're at then. I'm just not quite ready to retire, I don't think, because you're a long time finished, aren't you?
No way.
So I'm not on the immediate horizon, but certainly after the amount of time I've been in the game, I'm closer to the finish than I am the beginning, I'm sure.
At the furlong.
Yeah, I'm probably at the furlong.
Yeah. Are you still enjoying it?
Yeah, I must say I am. I still love going to the track.
Yeah.
It's the grind that sometimes gets you down. It's the hours of preparation before that. Yeah. But come race day, I'm bouncing and ready to go to the track, because there's still that beautiful feeling when you're walking on the track of expectation that something special's going to happen today, and I'm privileged enough to be a little part of it.
Yeah, that's a good point, and I agree with that, because it's a stage show, but it doesn't always have the same ending. And I say to junior callers, expect the unexpected, because they can run off, they can go over the fence, they can pull up, they can stop, all things can happen. Be ready.
Absolutely, yeah. That's one of the beauties of doing what we do.
Greg, son Daniel is involved in racing. Has he wanted to follow you at any stage?
He did when he was a kid, when he was much smaller, and he'd come along, and I took him to a meeting at Geelong one day, and he was probably about 10 years old, put him in a spare broadcast box and gave him a tape recorder, and he mucked around there all day, and we played the tape recorder on the way home in the car, and I said, my goodness, I said, did you find that difficult to do? He said, no. He was just rattling off horses' names, all in order. They were fresh in my memory. He got them right.
Beautiful.
So he could have done it, I believe, if he wanted to, but it wasn't something that really grabbed him. He's working in the racing industry now. He's got a pretty good job for Racing Victoria in the communications area there. Good. And he's learning, like we all do, that there's some fantastic people in the game, and he's enjoying his time. Whether that's going to be what he does, he's just about to turn 26 now, so he might do something completely different in a few years from now, but he's loving his time in racing right now.
26, remember that little tacker coming along, carrying the radio or the binoculars with you?
Yeah, time goes too quickly, Brian.
Good calling today, mate. It's a special day. I'll be a couple of boxes down from you. We might have a cuppa halfway through the day and chew the fat and talk about rubbish and everything else.
We'll do that just like we've done for the last hour or so. But it's been a pleasure working with you all those years, Brian. It's been a great pleasure being in the studio with you today.
Good morning. My pleasure too. Good on you. Greg Miles, our guest this morning on This Is Your Racing Life.